Good evening, everyone. This is our third in our continuing series on the Nanciv. It's today is February 17th, so I'm just gonna pick up right where we left off. And the last thing I said was I was referring to this booklet, or this is one of the things I said on Nanciv and his relationship to Chibat Zion by Yitzhak Rifkind, and I said I would check on that, and indeed he died in 1968. He studied both in Volozhin and in Ponevezh. He was a member of Mizrahi that I knew, and he also was became eventually chief librarian, or the Hebraica section at JTS. And he wrote a number of interesting works. And in fact, it reminds me now, I'm looking at the article of his that appeared in the Encyclopedia Judaica. That he also published, it was in the Ginsberg, Louis Ginsberg Jubilee volume, the famous Tshuva Responsum of Rabbi Leon Modna. I think some of the people listening here have been to Italy with me. We speak about that when we go to Venice. Leon Modna, who has a few interesting responsa, one of his is about wearing a kippah. You know, in my book, Changing the Immutable, I have a picture of Leon Modna with, he was one of the leading rabbis in Venice. But of a strange character, though, because he also he wrote an autobiography, which always is unusual, and he confesses in it how, in addition to all the other things, he confesses that he was addicted to gambling, and he was always out of money because he was always losing it when he was gambling. But he wrote a tshuva permitting, walking barehanded. He's not the only one to say that, or even the first one to say that. But this is a whole responsum. And was later included in his responsa. It's called Sheva Teshuvot Ziknei Yehuda, and so I see that that reminds me that he published this as Rifkind. He also, I see from the article in Encyclopedia here, the tshuva appeared in Tarbitz, Moses Provençal on Ball Playing. That's a tshuva by Ramosha Provençali, also an important Italian sage around the same time as Modna, who wrote a tshuva permitting the playing of, they didn't call it tennis, but it's sort of like tennis. They called it racket, and in they used to play that, so it's about on Shabbos. And Modna actually permitted playing racket on Shabbos in the ghetto of Venice as well. So that's Yitzhak Rifkind. We'll come back to this booklet of his hopefully today, when we deal with Chibat Tzion. Let us move on. The last thing I mentioned was I believe. We started speaking a little bit about Chibat Zion, and I said that the Nitziv, who of course is going to be important in terms of the new Yishuv, still connected himself to the old Yishuv. And I believe this is the last thing I said, that he was against doing anything that would take money away from the old Yishuv, that is removing the Pushkas, that were the Remeir Baal HaNes. So in addition to pushing the new Yishuv, he also had respect and wanted to keep the old Yishuv. So now let's begin. He did, however, depart from the old Yishuv in significant ways, in ways that had he lived in Eretz Yisrael, he would have been attacked in Punah Haram, just like to the Lev Ivri, Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger. If we think about the Lev Ivri today, I mean, he's regarded as a typical, extremist. He has descendants who are now part of the Yedda Haredit. His views were extreme on so many areas, and they've recently published his responsa. However, he was also a big believer in the return to Eretz Yisrael, and that led to him being put in Cheirem because he did not believe in the chalukah system, and he wanted people to go out and work. Well, hopefully we'll get to classes on Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, the Lev Ivri as well. But the same sort of thing would have been the case had the Nitziv gone to Eretz Yisrael, had he followed his father and his brother to Eretz Yisrael. So, for instance, he suggested moving people out of Jerusalem to work in the new settlements. Remember, we spoke about this in previous classes, but you had, unlike the Sfaradim, who never had this conception, you had the four so-called holy cities, Jerusalem, Hebron, Tveria, and Tzfat, and the Ashkenazim had this conception that they're not supposed to work, that they're supposed to be supported and until the days of the Mashiach. I guess in the days of the Mashiach they won't work either because everyone will be learning. So they had this conception of not working. And this is all challenged by people like the Lviv Rih, by the new Yishuv, because now you're opening settlements. And the Nitziv mentions that it's important to get people from Jerusalem, which was the center of this philosophy, to go to the new colonies. Another case, though, that shows that he deferred to the old Yishuv is with Yechiel Michal Pinhas. Yechiel Michal Pinhas, a big Talmid Chacham from a rabbinic family, he comes to Eretz Yisrael, and he too, much like the Lviv Rih, is starting with new suggestions and how to, change the educational system. And it wasn't long before he was the brother-in-law of Rav David Friedman of Karlin. It wasn't long before he was being attacked and being put in Cheirem, and the Nitziv did not want to intervene in that. That's a very interesting episode, as I recall. Eitam Henkin, Hashem Yikom Damo, wrote about that. Now, the interesting thing is that Yechiel Michal Pinhas, although everyone knows that he was attacked and condemned, he was condemned by Rabbi Diskin. There was the chief rabbi was Rabbi Shmuel Salant, who was quite moderate. On the other hand, there was Rabbi Diskin, who was in Brisk actually before he came to Eretz Yisrael. And he, although in Europe there was no ten tendencies of being extreme in any way, he becomes very much attached to the extremist elements when he comes to Eretz Yisrael. And he is really, although he did not hold an official position, he is a source of power that is at odds with Rabbi Diskin. And if you want to know the development of the extremist population, which we suffer with until this day in the land of Israel, a lot of this goes back to the machlokas between Rav Shmuel Salant and Rav Diskin, and actually the Diskin orphanage later becomes the center for the attacks on Rav Kook. The Nitziv, however, in one other area, fit in very well with the old Yishuv. He was a strong advocate that the new Yishuvim, which themselves, as I said, were at odds with the old Yishuv, but he was a strong advocate that the new Yishuvim observe Shemitah without the Heter Mechira. Those who are interested, you can go back to the classes we had on Yitzchak Chanan Spector, and we spoke about this whole idea of the Heter Mechira, which really, Rav Yitzchak Chanan, and not just him, Bolivar and others were convinced that it was an economic necessity, and I think it was an economic necessity, to find some solution. Otherwise, the colonies would just completely go bankrupt and everyone would leave, and the notion of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael would be destroyed. So Rav Yitzchak Chanan Spector, who is, of course, at this time, the greatest halachic authority in Eastern Europe, he signed on to the Heter Mechira. And after he signs on to it, many people follow him. And it's true, there was a lot of pressure on him because it literally was a do or die situation for the Yishuv, the new Yishuv. But the Nitziv is opposed to this. And he believes that with charity from abroad, the Yishuv could remain. Later on, we'll talk about some of the halachic arguments and a great misunderstanding that's been repeated by many people when it comes to the Nitziv's position. We have to thank again Eitam Henkin, who wrote so much about this period and these individuals. We'll have to thank him. But for now, I'll just mention that he believed that we could support the colonists, and he sent money there. Money that was given to the Nitziv to support Yishuv Haaretz, he sent it to the new Yishuv so that they could survive. I don't believe in the end, though, any of the, I forget, we'll have to go back to this. We spoke about this with Rivitzel Chorin. I think all the early colonists at this time who remained on the land availed themselves of the Heter Mechira. And the Sephardic rabbis, there wasn't even Machlokas. They went along with this without any issues. But the Nitziv, in discussing what the new Yishuv would do, if they're not working the land, what are they supposed to do? I mean, Mike Bloomberg just said that it's easy to be a farmer. Just put some seeds in and it grows, but the technology might be easy, but it's hard work. And if they're not working, and even if they're assumed they're being supported, what are they supposed to do? Well, the Nitziv has the solution. He says that each settlement should appoint Torah teachers, and that's how these people would spend the entire year, the Shemitah year. They'd spend it learning, something which really they wouldn't be able to do during the year because they'd be busy working. They have a wonderful opportunity for every 7 years to devote an entire year, a sabbatical. Sort of like, you know, we use this term. I had a sabbatical a few years ago, though, although I only had it for half a year. If I want to take the full year, they don't pay me for second semester. But the whole idea of sabbatical is exactly what the missive is talking about. So we've taken the idea of sabbatical as a chance to do research, etc. That's what the missive did. And I don't know anyone else who ever spoke about this before the Nitziv. The idea that he says this will be a sabbatical for them from work, not just the land is lying without being worked, but the people won't have work and they will do what Jews are supposed to do when they're not working, namely devoted to Torah study. So it's an unbelievable concept the Nitziv speaks about that lay people, workers with their hands, will themselves have a sabbatical in which they can devote themselves to Torah studies. I find that quite interesting. And as I mentioned, he points out that you need to appoint Torah scholars to be in each one of these settlements to teach the Torah. Another interesting point I'll mention is that in Meir Berlin, Bar-Ilan's memoir of his father, on page 95 to 96, he points out something interesting. He says it's the last winter of his father's life. And he even mentions who his teacher was. His name was Naftali Herzog. And he speaks about how this Naftali Herzog, who was hired by his father to teach him, he was the Melamed, was very opposed to the new Yeshiva Aretz. He didn't believe in this proto-Zionism. And he tried to influence his young student, namely the Nitziv, not to. And then when Meir Bar-Ilan tells us when this was unsuccessful, he tried a different approach, and he says that it's forbidden, asur, for Meir Berlin to support the new yeshuv in any way. Why? Because the new yeshuv, they're holding by the Heter Mechira, and his father said the Heter Mechira is asur, and therefore they're going against the word of the great Gadol the Nitziv, and therefore you can't support it. So he describes how they went to his father, and his father says, "Yes, I certainly oppose the Heter Mechira." But since there are other rabbis, great rabbis, who permit it, and they're listening to them, we can't, you know, they have the freedom to do this. And in other words, that this you're, the Melamed's wrong. You can still support the Yishuv. And Berlin continues to say that right at the end, towards the end of his life, his last Pesach, he received a bottle of wine from the Carmel, the Kerem Rishon and Rishon LeZion. These are the first bottles, and he describes how he was very moved by this, that he lived to see once again Eretz Yisrael, you know, producing in this way, and that you know, producing, and that we can now appreciate the kedusha of the land, etc. Maslyansky, the memoirist, Zvi Hirsch Maslyansky, who I've spoken a bit about in the past, I wrote about him on one of my blog posts, he records, and he knew all these figures, that the Nitziv actually said that his hope is that when he dies, they'd be able to bring his bones to Eretz Yisrael. Not so simple in those days. You may have to transfer on a boat, I guess the whole bit, but that was his wish, because he obviously knew he wasn't going to make it to Eretz Yisrael. He had a yeshiva, he had a community, he wasn't going to leave that, but he still wanted to be buried there. We'll come back a little bit later today to Chovei Tzion. We'll speak about a number of things that Nitziv wrote about it, his ideas, how you can join together with the irreligious, what's his whole approach, his whole philosophy. So we'll come back to that, but I want to move on now to discuss, you know, as we're going with his biography, I don't want to get ahead of myself, some of his writings. And let's, even before we do that, let me just say that we have, you know, of his writings, we have a great deal published by himself. We also have some posthumous writings, commentaries on Midrash in particular. And that was what the focus of this book that I've mentioned a few times. By Gil Perl, the first book in my series, which I highly recommend. And the problem is, with the posthumous publications. Because, as is often the case, we don't know if we're getting completely authentic texts or we get in texts that have been touched up. Pearl discusses this in particular on pages 36 and on. He has a whole section there dealing with censorship. The Nisiv was such a wide-ranging, had such wide-ranging interests that he obviously was going to read things and be interested in things that maybe his descendants, because he has two types of descendants in different circles, but some of them would not want to reprint. And Pearl speaks about, and you can hear, and the video that I've recommended, he also tells the story that when he got to look at, he had certain places that he wanted to see in the manuscript, and they let him see it. But here he speaks in particular that in the Nitziv's commentary on Shoftim, it refers to Hakdamat Chumash Besau, and then it says, then Vav Tav Aleph. So what does Vav Tav Aleph means? Normally it means unkos. But Pearl points out that in this case, it doesn't make any sense, and he's thinking that maybe Vav Tav Aleph means the Targum Ashkenaz. And what would Besau mean then? Besau would mean it's a mistake. It wouldn't be Besau. They read it, they got it wrong. It's actually Desau. And he says in the note here on note on page 37 that he says my access to, he wanted to check to see if what he says is correct. And he writes, my access to the manuscript was always limited by sitting next to a member of the Shapiro family. They're the ones who hold it, they're the descendants, who would turn to the page I wish to check and look at the specific textual anomaly before deciding whether to let me look as well. In other words, Pearl would have a problem. Something doesn't make sense in the text. He wants to see the manuscript. So he asked them, they look at it, and then they decide if he could see it. In this case, they didn't want to show it to him, but he's sitting next to them and he sees what they're. I was able to peer over his shoulder and attempt to decipher the acronym. Actually, this is, I'm sorry, this is referring to an earlier case of a censorship. But he says the exact response of this member of the Shapiro family to this particular request was, quote, suffice it to say, it's not a siman in Shulchan Aruch. That's something else he's citing. But as for the Dessau, what is Dessau? Well, here I have to correct Gil Pearl. He says the citation would be to the well-known introduction to Moses Mendelssohn's Torah commentary, which was printed in Dessau and contains a German translation of the biblical text. That's true. It's no question that that's what it's referring to. However, the commentary was Mendelssohn's commentary was not printed in Dessau. Dessau was where Mendelssohn was born. It's I don't know, maybe today it's like an hour by car from Berlin. You can check online. The commentary is printed in Berlin. However, Moses Mendelssohn in rabbinic literature is called Moshe Dessau. Sometimes he's called Moshe Midessau, but usually it's just called Moshe Dessau or Moshe Dessauer. So what it says and what Pearl discovered is Hakdamat Chumash Dessau, as in Moshe Dessau, and the Tav Aleph, the Targum Ashkenaz. Because remember, there's two things. You have the commentary of Mendelssohn or his collaborators, Wesley, Dubnow, etc. And together with that, you have the German translation. And they looked long and hard to find a reason to ban it because of what Mendelssohn said. And they were never able to find any real heresy in the commentary. Maybe one or two sections that are a little bit problematic, but for all, basically, the commentary is 100% kosher commentary. The real problem they had was that we're talking about the rabbis who opposed it. Contrary to popular belief, many, many rabbis, Gedolei Yisrael, signed on and were subscribers to the Mendelssohn Parish. But the ones who opposed it, the Note of Yehuda is most famous, the issue was they thought that this would lead people to take the commentary, take the book to study German, to learn German, and become acculturated, etc. So we have to know that when we, because Gil Pearl has shown us this, we never would have known without his uncovering this, that with the posthumous writings in the Nitziv, published by at least some of the members of the family, you always have to wonder if you're getting the whole picture. And it's a real problem because when people feel that they can just censor and just take out sections that they don't feel that people today should know about, you're not going to get a complete picture of who the Nitziv is. And look, I wrote a whole book on this, so I don't need to repeat it. We'll come later in this class, if not today, next class, about censorships in the Meshiv Dover itself, which I will show you his responsa. But I mean, the idea is amazing when you think about it. And it's we're not talking about a private letter or something. Then Tziv writes a commentary that he wants to publish, but he passes away before he's able to publish, and his descendants feel that they can veto what their grandfather said. That they decide, despite what he wanted to include, they choose not to include it. But that's we've seen that again and again. Okay, his first major work, the Nitziv's first major work, is appears in three volumes. It's a commentary on a work called the Shiltos of Rav Chai Gaon. Who is Rav Chai Gaon, and what is this work? Well, this is generally regarded as the first post-Talmudic halachic text. Now, how to pronounce the commentary? That's also, if you look in Pearl on page 17, he raises the question because the Nitziv has a commentary. If you look at it, it's well, the first word would be ha'amek, but what's the second word supposed to be? Most people think it's, and this is what he quotes Professor Septimus as saying, it's based on a verse in Yeshaya. She'ala. That he's using the verse. On the other hand, what does this mean? Ha'amek she'ala. It's very strange because what sink to the depths or we know what Sheol is. Sheol is the netherworld, the afterlife, but not the good afterlife, the place you don't want to be. I shouldn't say that because in Torah itself, everyone sends to Sheol, but still, why would that be the title? So. And there's no tradition, Pearl points out as well, that that's what it's called. He prefers she'ela, which would be because they're called a shiltot. Each section of the shiltos is divided into a section called a shilta. So it's not clear how it should be pronounced, the commentary, but what the work is, I sort of look at it like, because I've tried to go through parts of it, and I don't know who studies it other than Rabbi Tendler. I was in the Tendler shul a few years ago, and lo and behold, Friday night, or is it Shabbos afternoon? I forget now. I think it was Friday night. He gives a shiur on in the winter in the Shiltos. Now, the Shiltos, it's not exactly a common work, and the commentary of the Nitziv, it reminds me a bit like the Minchas Chinuch. The Minchas Chinuch is ostensibly in the Sefer Chinuch, but if you read the Minchas Chinuch, it's on everything. It's and then he uses the Sefer Chinuch as a jumping-off point to do whatever he wants to do and discuss, and he's machadesh in all different areas that have nothing to do with the Sefer HaChinuch. And that's really the Nitziv. If you try to look at it, you'll see that he's going off and he's giving his chidushim on everything, and it's loosely attached. The fact that he writes a commentary, and I'll get to all the questions, of course, and comments in about a little less than half hour. Of course, the fact that he writes the commentary in the Shiltos already tells you something about the Nitziv and his because I tell you, the fact that the Nitziv chose to write a commentary on the Shiltos is not part of the curriculum. It's not part of the canon. We'll see this with the Nitziv again and again. He studies things that no one else was studying, which really shows his uniqueness. And also, I think, why someone like Rav Kook would be so attached to him. Rav Kook was also studying things that the typical student in Eastern Europe wasn't. So the fact that he's writing on the Shiltos itself is significant, despite quite apart from what he says. Also, the halachic midrashim, which we'll talk about a little bit later. Who is studying Mechilta and Sifrei? These are not part of the traditional curriculum, but the Nitziv is much broader than most. He's not a typical Rosh Yeshiva. He also published his famous and oft-reprinted commentary on the Chumash, which it's also is not something that we usually think of Rosh Yeshiva spending their time on. Ha'amek Davar, we saw last class that he gave a shiur in Chumash every single day. So obviously that came, it was easy for him to keep up on that. He was constantly focusing on Chumash. Berlin in Rabban Shel Yisrael, page 51, explains to us how it happened, or what I should say, his strong connection to this Chumash commentary. And it's a very special Chumash commentary because we see in it, and he discussed this already in the introduction, he was very much connected to Hebrew grammar, to the nuances of the Hebrew language, attention to things that most people are not. So it's a very unusual commentary. It's not what you would think of. Maybe a Rosh Yeshiva would speak about halachic issues and other things. The Netziv's breath is really striking. So the son tells us that he mentions in the yeshiva, as we've seen, that he gave a chumash here. He says though that in other yeshivas, there wasn't a teacher and there wasn't a Talmud who were interested in learning chumash. The only point of learning chumash is Kriyas HaTorah. That's you have to know how to read it, and then you have to do Shnayim Mikra and to teach children in Cheder. That's the extent Be'er Berlin says that people focused on Chumash. But Eizen Lamdan, Lomed et Chamisha Chumshe Torah be'iyun v'diyuk havana v'hakara, Be'er Berlin says correctly, what Lamdan is spending his time focusing in detail, fashion, on learning Chumash. But he says that his father, he calls him Rabban Shel Yisrael, when he would meet student, when he would come, meet students of the yeshiva, even the greatest of them, and he would see that they didn't know a certain pasuk the way it should be known, he would rebuke them, and he would say to them, "Today, you see, you don't know the Torah, you don't know the words of the Nevi'im or the Kesuvim. Kol ha-Tanakh zar b'chem. You don't know Tanakh at all." And while and pay attention to those words because. The Maskilim were the ones who focused on the study of Tanakh, so much so that the study of Tanakh was pushed out, where it was never part of the curriculum, but it wasn't something that people should even do. We even have tshuvot of one, I think, in particular, Shlomo Kluger, but I believe there's another one. The question was asked to him, is it permitted to study Tanakh, Nach, I should say, in any sort of profound way, because then you're going along with the Maskilim. But the Netziv had a different approach, and then he says, "You one day you'll become a rabbi in a community, and you'll have to darshan in front of the kahal, and then you're gonna pick up a navi, you're gonna see what you should darshan on. You'll know from that way part of Tanakh, however part of Nach. But I don't know why he's saying now they'll pick a navi to darshan. He says, but on Chumash." You'll never really know it if you don't learn it at present. He's saying that when they darshan, they're going to find something in Nach. But he says Chumash, you'll remain on Am Haaretz. And Meir Berlin continues that this helped a bit because he gave his Chumash here and some would come to listen to. But most, I'm sure, did not listen because just they didn't take it that seriously. I'm going to have more to say about the commentary. But for now, let me just mention the famous passage in the introduction to Bereishis, where I have a whole. This is all I could carry. The rest are downstairs, so I'll just say it to you outside. He quotes the Talmud, the famous Talmud that we all know, that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of Sinas Chinam, baseless hatred. Rav Kook, of course, famously says that the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed because of Sinas Chinam. It's going to be rebuilt because of Avas Chinam. That is, I guess, baseless love. That is just love of a fellow Jew, not because he does anything for you. Just stop. So it's destroyed because Sinas Chinam. So what does that mean, Sinas Chinam? Well, the Netziv says, he says, and he knew the history. He read Josephus, so he knew what was really going on there. He says that it refers to those who, when they were in religious disagreements with others, they assume that everyone who disagrees with them is a heretic or a Sadducee. And he says that this even led to bloodshed between Jews among themselves. And this is why he says the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, because God is Yashar, God is straight, and he cannot tolerate tzaddikim ka'elu, these type of tzaddikim. He's saying it sarcastically, But as we'll see, he's referring to people who were regarded as leaders in the Torah world in those days. But he calls them tzaddikim ke'elu, these type of tzaddikim who are always ready to put someone down because they're not as pious. You don't agree with me. You don't hold up my Das Torah, to use a 21st century way of putting it. Therefore, you're really not religious. And that's why the Beis Hamikdash is destroyed. And we have to put tzaddikim, of course, in quotes. Now, this is actually the subject. I mentioned Yo Pearl once, so I'll mention him again. It's actually the subject of an essay he wrote in the Torah Amada Journal number 12. And here's just the title page of it. No two minds are alike: tolerance and pluralism in the works in the work of Nitziv. Now, Pearl feels he needs to explain the Nitziv's view of religious tolerance and pluralism, that it was far from what we usually think of when we think of pluralism, like we think of John Locke, John Stuart Mill. And his views of religious tolerance and pluralism were not like those thinkers. Now, the reason why Pearl had to do that is because there's a great scholar. Unfortunately, he, Avi Revitsky, I mean, he was incredibly productive in all sorts of areas, not just in medieval Jewish philosophy, but in modern thinkers. He was hit by a bus a number of years ago, and although he's alive and he's conscious, his mind is not of the sort that he can write anymore. So it's a big loss. And Revitsky had written in an essay that there's a similarity between what the Nitziv is speaking about in ideas we're going to see soon, and what these political thinkers were writing about. And Pearl wants to reject that, and he's correct in what he writes. After all, no 19th century rabbinic scholar could ever countenance open heresy as part of Jewish society. I mean, you have no choice if there's heretics because we can't control them. But the idea that this is something that we aspire to, where the public square should be a forum for all ideas, and everyone should have a chance to convince everyone of what opinion is correct, and absolute freedom of expression, and that's not something the Nitziv or any other rabbinic authority could ever see as anything other than the fact that we live in a society where we can enforce this. And now Revitsky would agree with this. He wouldn't. He doesn't. He would not believe that the Nitziv is like that. But he does want to show parallels between the Nitziv and Locke and Mill in condemning persecution, for instance, that results from intolerance, in favor of a multiplicity of opinions, because if you have a multiplicity of opinions which meet and conflict, the correct opinion or the opinion that makes most sense will arise out of that conflict of opinions. The Nitziv also agrees with that, but the Nitziv, unlike Locke and Mill that believe that all opinions are fair game in the middle, the Nitziv is only referring to those opinions which he would conclude as part of general Orthodox society. He's not including heretical works. And when you think about it becomes almost a semantic game, because even the most extreme figures, let's say the Satmar, etc., they would agree with that as well. They would say all true Orthodox opinions should be able to be expressed, but their understanding of Orthodox opinions is so small that they would exclude all the other ones. But so they'll say you have the Satmar Rav, you have Rav Sonnenfeld, you have, so in other words, everyone perhaps holds this opinion. But Ravitsky does not, he knows full well that the Nitziv is not a believer in complete tolerance. Pearl, interestingly, in his passages in which he cites things that the Nitziv wrote in opposition to identifying him with any sort of enlightenment views about freedom of expression, he cites the Rambam that, it's a very famous passage of the Rambam that the Beis Din, in the days that the Beis Din had real authority, the Beis Din would appoint guards to prevent transgressions. That is, the men and women would gather by the lakes, the rivers, and there'd be mixing, tarovis, of men and women. And he says the job of the Beis Din is to appoint figures, like in Iran, I guess you could say, where they go around and do this, to make sure that the men and women do not mix. As far as I know, there never was any such position ever in history, in any community, where there were people whose job it was who actually did that. The Rambam says they should, Beis Din should do that, I'm unaware of any texts, actual texts from Egypt or anywhere else in the Sephardic world for that matter, that you actually had figures appointed by Beis Din whose job it was to go around like in Iran today and separate people. The rabbis wrote about this and they condemned the mixing, but I don't know of any time they actually had authority to do anything about it. Pearl concludes based on this then that Siv, quote, provides the theoretic legal basis for a halachic police state, which I think is putting the matter in too extreme a form. But the basic point remains because you think of police state, you think of actual punishments also. People don't follow it, not just sending people out to make sure that the men and women aren't mixing. Are you putting them in jail or anything like that? In any event, the basic point remains. Pearl also cites letters from the Netziv, in which he argues that the new settlements in Eretz Israel need to enforce halachic observance. How do you do that? The Netziv says if those people refuse to observe halacha in these settlements, he wants every settlement to be religious. We're going to see what he says when he sees that they're not all going to be religious and how to relate to people who are not going to be religious. But the early settlements were religious. And yet you had people, though, who, let's see, you have someone in the settlement who decides that he's going to smoke on Shabbos or something. The Netziv's answer is clear, that such a person should be told to leave and should not be allowed to remain in the community, which today in Eretz Yisrael, you have communities like this, where they're completely religious communities, completely Haredi communities. And if you don't observe the way they want you to, could be asked to leave. This position, incidentally, was opposed by Rav Shmuel Bolliver, who, together with the Netziv, was a leader in he's a founder of the Mizrahi movement, but a leader of the Tzil. We get a sense of the Netziv, where the Netziv stood, not just in his letters, but in a couple of his general letters, but in letters he published in this volume. You can see the title, Shivat Tzion. This is the reprint. You can see the original edition on, I'm sure it's on HebrewBooks.org. And this is actually the original typeset, the two volumes of this book published by Slutsky, Shivat Tzion, which is a classic, Chovei Tzion text, two volumes. But it was reprinted in 1998 together with notes and appendices. And a nice introduction by Yosef Salmon. Yosef Salmon, who's written a lot about the beginnings of religious Zionism. And the Netziv has letters here. The whole point of the Shivat Tzion book was to get letters from the great Rabbanim who supported Zionism, proto-Zionism. Later on, the exact same thing was done, but by the other side, the opposition. Not opposition to Chovei Tzion, that we don't have an organized opposition. But with the beginnings of political Zionism and the Mizrahi movement, you have a number of volumes. Tikkun Olam is one of them, and a few others in which they're written against religious Zionism. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, one of his letters against Zionism, is found in one of these texts. The name of the one he wrote it in, I forget which one it is, but. It's there. So in the Shivat Tzion, let me just read you some so you get a sense of the Netziv, what he's saying. And these are letters, they're Mikhtav Galoy. This is for the whole world to see the Netziv's position. The first one I want to call your attention to is on page 81 to 82. And let me just say a few things of what the Netziv has to say here. He's obviously writing in support of settlement in the land of Israel, of the new Yishuv. But you see, people are asking questions. Well, why should we be doing this? So listen to what the Netziv says. From his answer, you get the question. He says, "Ein lanu lachshav machshavot ki roi hayadavar gadol ze b'ofanim acherim kasher mitzuyar b'deyas b'nei adam." He says, "Don't start asking why did it come like this? Maybe it should have been differently." In other words, Chovei Tzion, the irreligious people involved. We're returning to the land of Israel. We're not returning because God came and sent the prophet. We're not returning because Mashiach came. He says, don't ask these sorts of questions. He says, Moshe Rabbeinu, was punished because of this. He said the B'nai Yisrael won't listen to me. They won't listen to my voice. If Moshe Rabbeinu was published from was punished from that, certainly in such an important thing, we see that we just have to do what we follow the opportunities we're given. And then he says that he goes on and says. I mean, remember, he said Moshe. See, the problem Moshe Rabbeinu, he explains, is that Moshe, he was saying that, it should be Aaron. The people expect Aaron. Me, who am I? So, too, we could say we expect that the Gula should come in the beginning of the Gula, return to Eretz Yisrael, should come in. He doesn't use the word, he's not really speaking messianically, but the return to Eretz Yisrael should come in a different way. But no, this is the way God's giving it to us. And then he continues on page. In volume two, he says, well, what about, he's answering the question, what about the people? He doesn't tell you he's answering the question, but seeing the answer. What about the fact that some of these people who are involved in Chovei Tzion, they're not the greatest tzaddikim, and some of the people who are going to go to Eretz Yisrael are not the greatest tzaddikim. So that's a common oppositional position. He says, but what about Ezra? He says, who returned in the days of Ezra? So there was Gedolei Torah, the Yirei Hashem, but also Osama Nashim Nosei Nashim Nachrios. Don't you remember the book of Ezra? What is it? Chapter 10, I think. They married foreign women, Babylonian women. And also he says, although this isn't in the text of Ezra, but he's assuming this, that they were Hayu Morgolim B'Chilul Shabbos, the way it was at Dar Klal. But we know they had to read the Torah for them. If they're marrying non-Jewish women, Kal V'chomer, they weren't observing Shabbos. And nevertheless, all these people joined together, V'hechinu Yishuv Haaretz. They were the ones who built the land. So too, we need to encourage all these people. And yes, if not everyone is 100% pious, they weren't 100% pious in the days of Ezra. Our job is to help make them pious. So that's a reply, obviously, to the position that this can't be good because we have irreligious people involved. And then he continues. What about, well, let me tell you what he says so you know what people were saying. He says, we don't ask. Ein lanu lishol v'lachkor. Madua be'emes lo haisa siyata yishmael migo espanya. Yekach. People were saying, well, why now? If really this is something that God wants us to do, then he would have brought it. He would have brought it in the days of the Rishonim, the great Tzaddikim. He would have brought it in Spain. When the Jews were thrown out of Spain, they had nowhere to go. The fact is that God never created a situation before, and those people are much greater than us. So this must mean that, this is like something from the Satan or whatever. This is not, we should not be returning to Eretz Yisrael because God would do it if he wanted to. And if he wanted to, he would have done it in an era much better than ours when we meet it. He says, are we better than previous generations? But he says, Hanistaros Hashem. We can't figure out God's ways are mysterious. And just like he says, we cannot understand and investigate why God decided to destroy the Asaras Shvatim, the 10 tribes. Why did he try to destroy them when he did in 7 days of Ahav? Ahav was the worst of the kings. So why did God wait until a later generation to destroy them? And also he says, what about Golos Yehuda and days of Tzidkiyahu? Why not days of Menashe? We can't explain why God decides to do a bad thing to the Jewish people in one generation as opposed to a different one. And so too, we can't decide why in our generation he decides to allow us to have this wonderful opportunity to return to Eretz Yisrael, and why he didn't give this opportunity to the generation of Rashi or Abarbanel, etc., etc. He says, "Ela hanistaros l'Hashem Elokeinu." All we have, he says, is hanigoslan. That's which apparent that now shenis ora harayon bekerav Yisrael. He says, from the one side, now that the idea of return to the land of Israel has arisen from one side of the world to the other side, b'chol makom. Asher anachnu mefuzarim. Everywhere Jews are, they're speaking about returning to the land. And then he says, "V'kol hamon k'kol Shaddai." This is an expression. It's not found in the Gemara anywhere. But it's a common already from medieval times, the idea of kol hamon kol shaddai. That is, it's actually there's a Latin. There's a Latin expression as well. The voice of the people is the voice of God. If all of Klal Yisrael has latched onto this, and it obviously means when you say kol hamon, you mean the religious Jews. He doesn't mean, we just mentioned Ahav. If you go back to the days of the prophets, the days of the kings, most of the Jews are worshiping Baal, it seems, in Eretz Yisrael. But if the religious community has latched on to this, then this is obviously what God wants. So he says, therefore, we must continue what we're doing. Et cetera, et cetera. This notion of kol hamon kol shaddai, I use this in an essay, which I haven't yet published, focusing on Jewish law, because we have a number of cases where the people, the masses, in front of the pious masses, do things that appear to be against Jewish law, explicit Jewish laws. And the rabbis protest, but the people don't listen. So what are you supposed to do? Well, then starts the phenomenon known as limud zchus. You start finding poskim who start saying, well, it must be, since everyone's doing it, and even though we don't know how it can be justified, there must be some justification, because they have this conception, and the Tzitz Eliezer in one place mentions it explicitly, of kol hamon kol shaddai, that if the pious Jews are doing something, even if it appears to us to be inappropriate, there must be some justification, that, and we just have to look hard for it and see if we can find it, or maybe we won't be able to find it. But it's hard for us to say that all these pious Jews, especially sometimes the generations, are doing something inappropriate. It goes, well, let me just give you an example. There's a number of examples of this, but one that I include in the essay. There's an explicit halakha, which is unquestioned. The lawyers would call it black letter law, that if you eat food that's wet, you have to wash. And yet, for hundreds of years now, people have not been doing that. And all the post-games try to wonder, why do people not follow this law? We do it once, I should, in Chutzlar, it's twice a year. We commemorate this halacha, which is in all the codes, on Pesach, when we wash, but not for motzi, for karpas. But why don't people do it? So the rabbi screamed, and but the people didn't listen for whatever reason. Maybe they thought it was too complicated, too difficult. I don't know. But then you start seeing the phenomenon of the limud zchus, that there must be some reason. If we see all these pious people who are doing this, there must be some justification. And they try to find it, that maybe they say things like the Olam. The Olam is relying on a view of the Rishonim, but that's not the. From a historical standpoint, the Olam is not relying on anyone. The Olam doesn't know about this view of the Rishon. The masses just do what the masses want to do. But from a halachic standpoint, you want to see if you can find a limud zchus. And as I said, this notion of kol hamon kol shaddai is sometimes quoted explicitly, and it's always there in the background, the idea of a pious community. That what a pious community does, Chaim Soloveitchik has written about this as well, has an assumption of legitimacy, which we cannot have today, because today our communities are not biased to begin with. And second of all, we're too much aware of this. Rav Kook writes about this. Rav Kook as well speaks about this. But when Yitz Greenberg, for instance, said that in pushing feminism, he says the women should make facts on the ground, and then the rabbis would have to justify it after the fact, like they did in the past. It doesn't really work like that, because this only works when you're dealing with a community that organically decides to either, violate a halacha or do something that seems strange, and then the rabbis have to deal with it. We're not dealing with consciously and saying, "Well, I know the halacha is this, and I'm going to do otherwise." So it really doesn't work. What Rabbi Yitz Greenberg suggests. Another example: it says the halacha is you can't lend money to someone if you don't have witnesses, and yet the people don't do that. The people stop doing it. We know why they stop doing it. It's too difficult. Every time you're going to lend someone some money, you're going to ask for witnesses. The Gemara says you have to do that. So people then, otherwise, if I lend money to someone, he might forget about it, and I have no proof. Then it's like geneva. So we want to prevent that. But again, it's the same thing. People stop doing it, and we have many examples of this. It's a whole Chaim Soloveitchik, Ephraim Orbach, Yaakov Katz. They've all written about this phenomenon of what appears to be conflicts between the practices of the people and the laws as they appear. in the books. Okay, I'm going to stop here. We're still going to continue. We want to continue with what the Nitziv's understanding of the community and how everyone is part of the community, especially with relevance to the return to Eretz Yisrael. But then I'm going to move into his most famous tshuva, I think, the one dealing with extremism, the right and the left. It's volume one, number 44, in which he really sets forth his notion of what it means to be a klal, how we fight internally, but when we deal with the outside world, we go to them as a unit, as a unity, and we forget about our internal feuds. And we'll see how this then plays out, obviously, with Rav Kook, with Rav Soloveitchik, and a number of famous things. I'll also show you, regarding Rav Soloveitchik, I forgot to mention, I'll mention next class, the whole idea of kol dodi dofek is mentioned by the Nitziv. As far as I know, no one has ever mentioned this before, that the Nitziv speaks about the notion of kol dodi dofek with reference to return to the land of Israel. And I don't know if the Rav knew this. The Rav never mentions it. And as far as I know, none of the people who discuss the Rav's idea of kol dodi dofek, well, next class I'll talk about the six knocks. But there's another knock, and that's the knock that the Nitziv refers to. And he actually, it seems it might be too much of a coincidence. He's an anacle. The Rav is an anacle of the Nitziv, a grand anacle. And I would like to think that he knew this notion, but he doesn't mention it. But it seems too much of a coincidence. And I'll reveal what that is next class. So now it's already 9:55. Let me go back and look at some of the comments and questions. And because when people listen to these classes later, they're not watching it. So therefore, I repeat what's said here so they can know what we're talking about. Baruch says, Leon Modena. It's pronounced Modena, not Modena. The city. The city is a city in Italy today. It's Modena. There still is a synagogue. You can go there. Moshe from Lakewood says the Marashah has a tshuva about ball play on Shabbos. You know, I do not recall the tshuva. Please send it to me, the tshuva. What the Marashah does have, he's the one that's so strong about also that kippah, there's no obligation on kippah, it's just a minhag, like the Vilna Gaon as well. William Gewert says there's an incredible tshuva that supported secular studies in Israel by Rav David Karliner. Exactly, and Schneer Lyman in that volume, which won, as I recall, a National Jewish Book Award. It's edited by J.J. Schachter. It has Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's essay, a conceptual secular studies in a conceptual framework, and it has Gerald Blitzstein dealing with the Talmudic period, David Berger, the medieval period, and Schneer Lyman from the modern period. He discusses this letter, this tshuva of Rav David Karliner, where he's even though he's in opposition to secular studies in Russia, in Israel, it's critical to establish Jewish independence. Okay, Moshe says about the Kuntras Emek Bracha defending Pinnis, David Karliner. Shmuel says, I heard the Nitziv made sure to put on his big day Shabbos when he received that bottle of wine from the Yishuv. Could be, but it's not mentioned by Mayor Berlin. So yes, Baruch Maslyansky, that's what I'm referring to, the national preacher. Moshe from Lakewood, his father, Ravitzela, also looked at other books. He quoted extensively from the Beer and his Chumashir. The Ravitzela did, and if you want to know all the Gedolim who studied the Beor and who signed up for it, I recommend Meir Hildesheimer. I can send this to anyone who's interested. Meir Hildesheimer has a whole article on Mendelssohn in rabbinic literature. He has another article dealing with the Chasam Sofer on this. The Chasam Sofer, who was very strongly opposed to Mendelssohn, his great student, probably his most premier student, the Maharam Shik, studied Mendelssohn. And it's in the Tshuva, once the Chasam Sofer was at the Maharam Shik, and he asked him for a chumash. And the Maharam Shik, the only chumash he had handy was the Mendelssohn chumash, and he gave it to the Chasam Sofer, and the Chasam Sofer didn't want to use it. And the Maharam Shik asked him, well, what's wrong with it? And he points to a certain passage, which he says is problematic. Lyman translated that whole thing into English. And the question is, what exactly is problematic that the Chasam Sofer is pointing to. I just saw the other day that Rabbi Rochum Perlman of Minsk, in explaining what's wrong with Mendelssohn, Mendelssohn, he becomes worse and worse over the generations. So today, Mendelssohn is like a Shem Rishayim. When the Jewish Observer about 25 years ago wanted to publish, I think it was Shaffer, if I'm not mistaken, an article. I wouldn't say rehabilitating him, but saying that Mendelssohn's real problem was he was a religious guy. He just didn't listen to Das Torah. That's the Musar Haskel. They had to retract it. But in because it was reviewed as scandalous to even find something positive about Mendelssohn. But in German Orthodoxy, he was always viewed as, like the first modern Orthodox Jew, and many of the Gedolim studied him, his writings, and thought that he was kosher, 100%. But Rav Yerucham Perlman says that you can't find any heresy, any problems in the Biur. Any actual problems, he says. So what's the real issue? He says that issues as follows: like you'll have a pasuk that refers to, let's say, the Messianic something like that. You look in Mendelssohn's Peirush, Rashi will say it refers to the Messianic era. Let's say the Rashbam sees it as not referring to the Messianic era, so he'll quote the Rashbam. And then you'll have another pasuk that Rashbam says it refers to the Messianic era, the resurrection, or something like that. And Rashi says no, he just interprets it al pi upshat. So in that pasuk, he'll go with Rashi. So what the Gadol of Minsk said. That it's not that he says anything wrong, it's that what he doesn't say. That is, he has a way in his commentary of subtly removing all possibilities of things, ideas he doesn't like. And that, he says, is the real problem with Mendelssohn. Take it or leave it. LED says, Rav Itzel used the B or only Rav Shua Levin? LED says, yeah. No, I believe it's Rav Itzel as well, but we'll have to check. And Moshe is usually right about these things. So, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky or Akiva Eiger read the Biur. The list goes on. He has an enormous list. Rav the Hasidic, they call him a Hasidic Rebbe. He really wasn't a Hasidic, but the Baal Shem of Michelstadt. I see Asher's with us. Asher Reimer, he came with me to Germany. And one of the places you go to, one of the graves, is the famous Michelstadt. It's beautiful little town to go to. You get a sense of what a Jewish life was like in this small town, and right next to this pool. But there's a kever of the famous Baal Shem of Michelstadt, and they come from all over Europe to go to his kever. He, the Baal Shem himself, studied and quoted from Mendelssohn. Concerning the Biur, does anyone still use it or refer to it nowadays? No. As far as I know, no. Other than academics, you can't even buy it. It hasn't been reprinted in a long time. You can see it online now, but for years before, the internet revolution, when you could access it online, I looked and looked to find the Biur, and I couldn't find it. And Shmuel says it was an impressive work. No question about it. It has value today. It has value, like any commentary has value. The same thing with Wesley, who was the major contributor in Vayikra, but his writings also were cited by, even though he was attacked by many Gedolim, he was cited by numerous Gedolim. Rabbi Tsuriel of Israel, best known for his writings on Rav Kook, has published a number of Hirsch Wesley's writings, and he has introductions in which he cites all the Gedolim who use the writings of Talmid Hirsch Wesley, including Rav Simcha Zissel of Kelm, incidentally. Harold Pearl says that Gil Pearl received a personal email from Rav Tali Tzvi Bar Ilan, great grandson of the Netziv, who confirmed that his grandfather received the library of the Netziv, which indeed had a copy of Mendelssohn's commentary on the Chumash. And it's good, that. Naftali Tzvi Bar Ilan, he's part from the Bar Ilan family that would not cover this up. So that's good to be confirmed. Quickly go to the end here. And I thank people for staying on when I had to go off for a minute. Okay, David, I don't have Fishman and Yitzchak in the Gittin. I don't have the Mishnah in front of me to check. Moshe says he sees in the Nitziv, returning to the way of the Rishonim. And speaking of grammar, yeah. Okay, so we're gonna come. Hopefully, we'll have time. We'll get into some of his commentaries. I believe you're correct. I mean, he says if you look in the introduction to the commentary, I mean, he's always pointing out. I mean, he makes it clear, you know, that these are not new ideas he has. Okay, so there's a similar comments. Shmuel says that the Nitziv, how much do we know how much it required attendance? It wasn't required. We don't know how many. We don't know how many in those days were attending the Chumash year. It's hard to know whether we know that it's. Well, I'll get back to that later with Rav Kook. You know, his Chumash commentary was attacked, but I know as far as I recall, none of the memoirs give numbers. Yes, Harold mentions the Nitziv read Dikduk. He didn't invent this from scratch. The Nitziv studied Dikduk. And again, I refer you to Gil Pearl's lecture on the topic. The Nitziv was interested in Dikduk. Okay, Moshe mentions the famous story in Yoma where the Kohen murders his co-worker and was only worried about ritual impurity. We'll go through that because it's not just in the introduction. The Nitziv has this theme which he repeats over and over again in a variety of places. The same idea that he says in the introduction of Breishis of the so-called tzaddikim, and if you don't agree with them, then you're a Rasha and you deserve to be killed even. He uses the phrase in one of his places in his commentary to Devarim, they killed people beheter. And that relates, of course, to a number of passages in the Talmud, which we'll get into it. Shmuel says, did the Nitziv ever comment about Machlokes he was dragged into? No. There's no comment that he, about that. Where would there be a comment? In his halachic writings, he doesn't comment. He never comments about the harassment of his first wife either. We only see that from his son. He never comments about the harassment of his as Meir Bar Ilan. The Nitziv never comments about the harassment of his own son either. These are things we know about from the memoirs of the students, from his nephew, the Torah Tamima, and from his son. Can one really be a religious Jew, Moshe says, and I have total religious tolerance in the modern sense? I think you could if you, first of all, you have to have your own state. So if you're in Israel, and if you develop the idea that today people you can't you know pressure them, you can't take away their freedoms, that the best way to encourage religion is through absolute freedom and absolute free speech, then you can. And if you look, America, the Kirov organizations have a lot more success, and the non-religious Jews in America don't hate religion; they're not opposed to it. It's just not for them. In Israel, you have many people, especially among the Ashkenazim, who really have a very negative view because religion for them is it's all about draft dodging and getting as much money as you can from the government. Not, you know, it's not, it's a very different thing. So you can create a whole system. Like Shimshon Raphael Hirsch believed that in modern times there is no place for religious coercion. And his great-grandson, Mordechai Breuer, Professor Mordechai Breuer of the Hirschian family, writes an article in Jewish Action in the early 90s in which he calls for getting rid of all religious coercion in Israel entirely. He says, because this is not the way to bring people to religion. If I were to say what I'm going to say to you right now, say it outside, people would call me an anti-religious person, an anti-Semite, this and that. But the fact is that there's a big problem in Israel if you believe in freedoms, and it doesn't help any, it doesn't help religion. Israel is the only country in the world where a Jew cannot get married by the rabbi of his or her choice. Why should that be? First of all, it creates also enormous halachic problems. We're forcing people, well, Rabbi Bleicher once said this, and he's correct. There's no halachic obligation to force people to get married religiously if they don't want to. You have all these Israelis that get married under the Rabbanut. Then they come to America, they're secular, and they get divorced, secular, and they remarry, and now the children are mamzerim, and they're it got to be so bad that Rav Elio Bakshi Doron, after he was no longer chief rabbi, wrote an article in which he revealed that when he went to the irreligious kibbutzim, he brought pasul witnesses. But think about this for a minute. Israel has religious coercion. Does that bring people closer to Torah? Shimshon Raphael Hirsch said absolutely not. He said medieval times is one thing. Today's day and age, it doesn't. So in answer to your question, Moshe, I think you can very easily develop a whole idea that be completely religious, but believe in religious tolerance in the same way that Locke and Mill would. Namely, that you do your thing, I do my thing. I am not going to try to interfere in your life. I will try to bring it to you, to the truth, but only through the powers of persuasion. And that's how we do it in America, and we're very successful. Okay, so many questions. My final thing is that Mel says on the most recent episode of David Lichtenstein's headline podcast, Pini Dunner speaks about the Netziv and the real reason for the closing of Volozhin. Nothing to do with secular studies. Yes, that is correct, and we will speak about that. And that's thanks to Shaul Stamfer and the closing of the archives, which we now know that story, and we shall get to it. And yes, Meir Bar-Ilan was very young when Netziv passed away. So public buses on Shabbos in Israel? Okay, I don't know. That's a different thing because that's run by the government. So Israel has never banned private cars. But when the government is running it, then you can say that the government, you don't want the government involved in the Chilul Shabbos. But that's not really violating, people's freedoms. It makes it more difficult for them, but it could be a little bit different. Okay, everyone. Thank you all. Pick up next week, God willing. Good night.